Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Good afternoon, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum. I'm Alex Zenos, Practice Groups Fellow at the Federalist Society. Today's Courthouse Steps program will be a discussion of NRSC v. FEC decided last week by the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining us, we have Brent Nolan, Senior Attorney at the Institute for Free Speech, and Madhura Sridharan, Solicitor General of Ohio. A couple of notes before we begin. As always, the Federalist Society does not take policy positions, and all views expressed in this session belong to our speakers. Towards the end of the program, time permitting, we'll take questions from the audience. So if you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen. And with that, I'll turn things over to start today's conversation.
All right. First of all, thanks to the Federalist Society for having us today. It's always wonderful to be on here discussing some of the latest and greatest opinions from the Supreme Court term. As was mentioned, we're discussing National Republican Senatorial Committee versus the Federal Election Commission today. I'm going to open up with sort of the case itself, the broad holdings, and talk about the majority, and turn it over to my friend Brett here to talk about the dissent and, you know, maybe some of our observations as time goes on. In a nutshell, this is a 6-3 decision with Justice Kavanaugh writing for the court, and the Supreme Court held that the Federal Election Campaign Act's limits on coordinated expenditures between political parties and their candidate campaigns violates the First Amendment. And so as part of that result, the court finally overruled FEC versus Colorado Republican Election Committee, which is fondly known as Colorado 2, and concluded that such restrictions can't survive modern First Amendment scrutiny. Now, let's talk about the law itself at issue. The FECA limits the amount a political party may spend in coordination with its preferred candidates. The challengers at the time, it was then Senator J.D. Vance, now Vice President J.D. Vance, and the National Republican Senatorial Committee. And the claim was that the coordinated expenditure limits burdens core political speech and association without sufficiently advancing the government's anti-corruption interests. Now, before the court got to the meat of the decision, which is the First Amendment merits discussion, it took a brief little stop at something that starts with the letter J, jurisdiction, talked about standing. And I think, and maybe this is an observation that Brett may agree or disagree with, but I do think that the court set and has been setting some looser thresholds for standing from candidates for the purpose of these sorts of election challenges. And in that vein, I guess starting from like Boast, for example, but now to NRSC, it said that Vice President Vance retained standing because he maintained an active statement of candidacy and campaign committee and a campaign committee for a future Senate race. And with that, the court turned to the First Amendment question itself. Now, there's a point that was discussed at the beginning, which is, I think, a feature of almost all First Amendment cases, which is what level of scrutiny should apply. Typically, election campaign cases have drawn a much criticized distinction between the level of scrutiny applied to restrictions on contributions from donors versus restrictions on expenditures, on what I view a fiction that expenditures are the party or the person's their own speech, whereas the contributions are slightly tangential or removed from core speech. Now, the court here didn't do away with that particular distinction, first because it held that the coordinated expenditure limits fail even the less demanding standard, which is coined closely drawn scrutiny. But nevertheless, I do think that the court's discussion of that, pointing out that the distinction is largely academic, signals a move away from this awkward distinction created between contributions and expenditures. And then it turned to what the government's proffered interests are and whether that satisfies the closely drawn scrutiny. Newsflash, it doesn't. At this point, the only permitted justification for restrictions on campaign finance requirements of the sort is quid pro quo corruption or the appearance thereof. Now, the court went a little further and sort of gave a history of a number of different justifications that were pressed when FICA was first, these particular restrictions in FICA were first enacted, including things like preventing excessive campaign spending, general donor influence or ingratiation and access, and pointed out that various precedents had already abrogated much of these, or actually directly rejected much of these justifications, leaving only one potential justification in this area, the appearance or the actual quid pro quo corruption. And consistent with that, the rationale that was being pressed here was that these restrictions on coordinated campaign spendings prevented donors from circumventing contribution limits through political parties. Now, the court takes that head on and says, no, such restrictions, even if they are meant for the purpose of an anti-circumvention, or are they're meant for the purpose of anti-circumvention, such restrictions are not sufficiently tailored, because when you take base contribution limits combined with earmarking rules and disclosure requirements, that's prophylaxis on prophylaxis on prophylaxis that does the job. When funds are earmarked, when they're given to political parties for a particular candidate, the law already requires that they count as candidate contributions. And so those earmarking rules combined with the modern access to anything that has been disclosed in this space deters corruption while facilitating enforcement. And because I'm a state lawyer, I do have to talk about the portion of the majority's decision here, talking about the fact that, you know, the state's experience reinforces that existing contribution limits, earmarking rules, and disclosure laws are adequate to guard against corruption. It was an argument that was also highlighted in Ohio's 20-state amicus brief that showed that coordinated expenditures have not produced the type of corruption that the federal restriction was designed to prevent. And ultimately, in order to get to the holding, the court finally goes through the stare decisis factors and overrules Colorado II for a number of reasons, including that the standard of review that it used at the time has since changed, in addition to a number of changes both in law as well as precedent that have significantly abrogated the value of that prior precedent. Now, before turning to the implications of all of this, the opinion prompted a vigorous dissent. Brent is going to walk through the dissent's principal arguments and sort of discuss where the justices parted ways.
Thank you. So this, you know, this was a 6-3 opinion. Justice Kagan authored the dissent. I think before the opinion came out, you know, you might have guessed it would have been 6-3. I wasn't so sure. This is kind of a pretty narrow case, and there's quite a bit of recent precedent that maybe makes the outcome a little inevitable. So I could have seen Justice Kagan, you know, perhaps concurring with the result and maybe writing separately about how the court didn't need to overrule Colorado to reach the result. But we got a dissent. It was pretty vigorous. You know, the key difference between the majority and the dissent really focuses on this idea of circumvention, which is that a donor is going to make a large contribution to a political party. Under the statutes, I think a donor could give up to almost $500,000 to various political parties for different purposes. With the kind of wink and a nod, maybe the silent understanding that that donation will actually just get funneled to the candidate. And so now you have come up with this clever way to get around the contribution limits. And so, and the reason that they're focused on the circumvention issue is that it's kind of nonsensical to make the argument that the political party itself is corrupting its own candidates if it's making donations or expenditures. That's why political parties exist. And so this circumvention argument is where the dissent's really focused on. An interesting, I think, part of the dynamic between the majority and the dissent that you see is the dissent really draws on what I think is more of a common sense kind of approach to dealing with this issue. The dissent's argument essentially is that, you know, there are these things called joint fundraising committees where a party and a candidate, they hold a fundraising event together, and it allows one donor to write one check to the joint fundraising committee. And then that check gets divvied up amongst the various people who are part of that, the candidates, the parties, the local parties. And then the dissent's argument is basically, of course, this is going to lead to circumvention because the donor is going to show up and make this large donation to a fundraising event that's, you know, hosted by a candidate and a party. So that money is absolutely going to go to the candidate, and that it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see that that would happen. You know, the majority's indirect response to that argument is that if that kind of thing happens, there's basically no evidence that this is a problem. Prior to these kinds of limits, there were some, you know, scandals about where the Democratic Party was tallying, how candidates raised money for the party, and the thought was they were trying to pay the candidates back. And there were some academic studies that that showed that parties don't operate in that way. That parties, when they collect money, the parties independently spend that where they think it's the most useful, not based on who is the best fundraiser or who's kind of giving them, you know, the most access to donors. As was mentioned earlier, there are, you know, more than half of the states don't impose these kinds of limits at all. And I think in a dozen of those states, there are low contribution limits. And so you would think, and I think Ohio might be one of these states, if I remember correctly, you think you would find a lot of this kind of circumvention and corruption where you have low individual contribution limits and no limits on coordination, and you don't see that at all. And so what you see between the dissent's kind of saying, well, of course that this is going to happen. Look how easy it is. And the majority's response is, if that exists, then the government's job under closely drawn, whatever the scrutiny is, it requires this narrow tailoring. It requires the government to come in and give evidence that this is a real problem that this law is going to solve. And that has been a theme that you've seen in some of these recent cases like McCutcheon and the Ted Cruz case, where the argument between the dissent and the majority is largely an argument about whether or not these problems are real and who should have to prove that. I don't think the dissent is particularly persuasive on this front. One of the tells when I read it is, you know, the dissent opens up with this claim about how donors can give parties up to $500,000, whereas they can only give candidates $7,000. But the reality is that $500,000 includes donations for things like legal fees and party conventions. And the federal law actually already allows political parties to have some unlimited coordination with candidates to do things like pay for legal fees. And when you drill down and so when you have this kind of argument about, is this a real problem or is this not, one of the problems that the dissent does not do a good job wrestling with is that there's already a lot of opportunity for political parties to coordinate with their candidates and to circumvent the contribution limits, doing things like paying for legal fees or paying for convention expenses, which are incredibly valuable to candidates, not just the parties. And you still don't see any of this kind of circumvention of the contribution limits. And so that dynamic, I think, is really pronounced here of, is this a real harm or is this not? Which is why you see the majority go through this analysis of, look, we already have contribution limits. We already make it illegal to earmark, right? So you can't give to a party and say, please give this to the candidate. That counts as a contribution, right? So, and then you already have these disclosure laws. So you have these multiple layers of prophylactic laws and regulations to stop this kind of circumvention, to stop this kind of quid pro quo corruption. Do we really need a fourth one or a fifth one? And when it comes to the fourth and the fifth one, the majority is saying the federal government, you have to come with evidence that this is a real problem. I think that that point, right, is if we think about where this case, you know, what this case does and maybe what the future is that's the real point here. In a lot of ways, this case is very narrow. The analysis draws a lot on the Cruz case and the McCutcheon case, and it does a lot of similar kind of moves. And you read it and you're like, well, that just feels really familiar. It doesn't feel that surprising. And I think that's true. And the real question is, how many times is this going to continue to happen with all of the campaign finance laws and regulations that are out there, where you have someone coming into court and saying, look, we already have disclosure laws and contribution limits. Do we really need this one? Do we really need this one? And you see the court's pretty committed to making the government kind of, you know, put up its evidence to defend these things. But at the same time, in this opinion, at least, the court is very clear that, like, you know, contribution limits are safe, right? Disclosure laws are safe. And we're just talking about the extra stuff and whether or not that's necessary. And so seeing how that kind of plays out with future challenges to future laws, I think is going to be really interesting. You talked about standing. I agree with you that it was a very loose application of the standing and mootness kind of rules. There's a lot of election disputes where you deal with mootness and standing, and there's pretty favorable rules to candidates already. But the sort of 2 to 3 sentences where the court says, well, he has Vice President Vance has this campaign committee, it still exists, and so it's not moot. That was, it was very cursory. And so I do think that you're seeing kind of the court wanting to resolve these election issues and you get to that. But there's one other thing that I think is pretty interesting that I will just flag that's not just related to election and campaign free speech stuff. At the beginning of the standing analysis, the court is kind of summarizing the argument that Vice President Vance doesn't have standing. And it has this sentence that I'll read, or a sentence and a half. It says, The argument that he doesn't have standing is that Vice President Vance no longer faces a credible threat of enforcement because the executive branch has concluded that the political party coordinated expenditure limits are unconstitutional. As a result, the Federal Election Commission presumably will no longer enforce the limits. Now, there's that sentence is kind of, it's not clear, is the court saying this on its own? Is it sort of summarizing what the argument was? It's not clear, but that's a huge kind of sentence to leave in there, because the FEC is famously structured in a very independent way. It has an even number of sort of party appointments. It requires bipartisan consensus in order to do basically anything. And obviously this opinion comes right after Slaughter, right after the court kind of emphasizing that the for-cause firing requirements for agencies are unconstitutional. There's no cite to Slaughter here. But this looks like a pretty strong statement that the FEC kind of is not going to operate independently of the president's, policy views or views on whether this is constitutional. When President Trump last year put out a statement about agencies needing to follow the administration's policy directives, the FEC was sued over that executive order. It was for this reason, because of the FEC's independence and whether or not that would be lawful. And the case, I think, was dismissed on standing or some other justiciability ground. But that was a really interesting statement for those who follow the FEC and this kind of election stuff closely, what that means for the FEC going forward.
That is a very big statement to leave in there, Brett. I think also the speed at which they blew through the jurisdictional points was a little surprising, given that there was actually supplemental briefing sought on it. But I do see that as potentially a new place where we might see slaughter-like changes or modifications to how the FEC operates. One thing I did think that your point about potentially this being a 9-0 decision, I actually think that was spot on for a couple of reasons. And I think I kind of only picked it up after the decision came out. You see a 6-3 decision, you see the media, you see the immediate reactions, partisan split. But the reactions in the academy among people who watch election law has actually been quite laudatory and almost unanimous in saying, wow, I am so glad the court got rid of these restrictions. Now, obviously, you have the speech hawks and the campaign finance deregulation side of things, but the majority itself cited to several political election reform advocates, professors in particular, Professor Pildes and Bob Bauer. And later, I also caught an article by one of my former professors, Professor Isaacroff, who applauded the court for getting rid of something that he and other members of the academy view as distorting viewpoints in the inadvertently distorting viewpoints in the election sphere, and advocating for the strength of political parties. And I think there's one other point that I didn't do a good job of highlighting how silly it was, but you picked it up, Brett, which was, honestly, these restrictions were put in place because there was this misguided assumption, and you should push back if you disagree with this misguided assumption that political parties could somehow be corrupted by their own candidates. That's what they exist to do. They're there to push messages, either their own or through their preferred candidates, to get candidates elected. And it was telling that by the time this was argued at the Supreme Court, every side, including the side appointed to defend the judgment below, every side had walked very far away from, I think, what was really animating these restrictions, which was this misunderstanding that political parties could somehow be corrupting or be corrupted by their preferred candidates.
Yeah, I mean, and to add, I think what you're getting at with some of the commentary about political parties being weakened, I mean, there is this idea among political scientists that, you know, what we're seeing today with grassroots fundraising is leading to really polarized party primary processes, right? Because the best way to raise money to make yourself known is to appeal to maybe the more extreme elements of the party, whereas political parties as institutions are often a moderating force, because what a political party wants to do is win a majority in the Senate, when in the House, so that the party can govern. And so a political party might put its resources, you know, the Republican Party might put resources into a more moderate candidate in a bluer state, thinking that it can win, where the primary voters might not do that. And when you weaken the ability of parties to support candidates, candidates are less loyal to the parties, and that moderating force from the party diminishes. And, you know, there's, I guess, a debate about, should that matter under the First Amendment, right? Should the First Amendment have anything to say? Should we treat parties better than other kinds of organizations? And that's a big question. But there is this element of, we have, this federal law has really hurt political parties, and by doing that has made our country and our parties much more polarized because of the primary process. And so whether that alters as parties start to have more ability to financially support or punish candidates and members of their party that can't get along or don't go along, we'll see.
I mean, and in terms of whether it matters to the First Amendment, certainly it doesn't matter to what speech means and the doctrine that's sort of developed around campaign finance. But restrictions are a one-way ratchet. You could always take restrictions away when it comes to speech. And I've seen some rallying calls from, I think, the entire political spectrum saying things like, you know, we should liberalize other restrictions in this area because all they're doing is distorting the marketplace of ideas in a way that that I think a lot of political theorists have found increases the voice of the fragmented sort of the niche interests that have the loudest influence. And I read it, this is that same article that sort of resonated with me, this line that these sorts of restrictions sever influence from responsibility. And I think that's a very poignant way of putting what these well-meaning restrictions actually do to the marketplace of ideas in elections.
Yeah. I see it looks like we have a question in the Q&A. What are the practical implications of this case for donors? Will it change their behavior? I think that that's, you know, probably some of the disagreement between the majority and the dissent, right? The dissent's view is that now donors might be writing bigger checks to political parties under the belief that this is going to, you know, give them more control or sway over a particular candidate. And maybe that's true. I think that it's almost certainly, I think the evidence doesn't support that, at least in the states where this happens. But even a less sort of corrupting kind of view of it is that, you know, donors might donate more to the parties, believing that the parties can use that money more effectively. And so before, when a party maybe was more limited in how it could coordinate with candidates and use the money, maybe a donor would pull back and give to, you know, a super PAC or something. And maybe those donors now, by donating to a party, will increase it because they think the party can be more effective.
Going to say, maybe putting a finer point on that, it's just, I think we're going to see bigger checks to or more money flowing into political parties. Now, whether or not that is because of a mistaken idea that it will garner more political favors, I mean, that's the difference between the dissent and the majority. But certainly it could create influence and ingratiation. And those are not problems. I mean, that is the ordinary political process. And the court has said that quite directly.
We've got another question. Couldn't an interest in strengthening parties and reducing polarization survive strict scrutiny? I have no idea. I don't think so. But maybe the court really hasn't dug into this. And one of the interesting, strange things about campaign finance restrictions is they seem to be treated differently than a lot of other speech restrictions where you think, oh, that's content-based. Automatically strict scrutiny is going to apply. It's not how the court treats it. And the difference between closely drawn, exacting, strict scrutiny, I think another thing that you're seeing from the courts is in these last cases, those differences are really drawn. They're getting very close. It's very hard to distinguish the narrow tailoring analysis. You know, the biggest difference is that we know for restricting contributions, preventing quid pro quo corruption in the appearance is the only legitimate interest the government has. But I wouldn't even want to guess what the court would do if you had an interest like that kind of on the table.
Yeah, I have no thoughts on that. I will say it would largely depend on what it could depend on what the law looks like, but my gut instinct is that it would not survive strict scrutiny or any of the heightened scrutiny. I mean, the court is rightfully so disfavors the state coming in and trying to move the message to what it thinks is the correct messenger. And that's just the First Amendment views that very unfavorably.
Another question here. Why would Justice Kavanaugh get such a big opinion instead of some of his more senior colleagues? Do you have a thought about that?
I don't think so. I have not followed the assignment spread and like looked through all of the charts as closely. There's been a lot of very big opinions, and I'm certain that they're likely spread pretty evenly among them. In fact, that's part of the fun of guessing who's going to write the next big one.
Yeah, I don't know either. You know, it's a big case, but also, you know, this opinion, it feels very much like an opinion Justice Kavanaugh would author. It's very, it's restrained. It's nuanced. There's it does. I'm not surprised. He had a lot of at the argument. He was very active and had a lot of interesting questions about things like the influence of political parties and, you know, what does it mean if we rule here for you for the cases down the road? So it doesn't surprise me after the argument he was assigned to this. One thing that is interesting about him getting this assignment is, and interesting about the opinion, I think, in general, is that it starts off with an analysis where he concludes, you know, that basically this law would probably violate the First Amendment if we were just looking at the text and kind of history of the Constitution, and that the only reason that we're doing anything else is because we've had a bunch of precedent over the last 50 years, precedent which he says, I think, something like clouded the issue. And Justice Kavanaugh is not, you know, maybe I don't think he's, it's not Justice Gorsuch or Justice Thomas where you expect that kind of originalist opinion maybe right out the gate. So it was interesting, and it was interesting that that got six votes to kind of have this possibly unnecessary kind of analysis of the history and tradition of the First Amendment to say it probably violates this, but we're bound by all this other precedent that's gotten in the way of modern First Amendment law. And I think that's it on our Q&A, and I believe we're about wrapped up for time here. Is that right?
Yes. Thank you guys so much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our panel for sharing their time and expertise with us. And I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.